dice jail, choosing a different die, or continuing to roll through the pain. What is your chosen modus operandi for whenever your die starts failing you?
See, this
If your dice isn't in dice jail, don't you have to choose a different die anyway?
Shh. It's fine. It's fine.
See, this
like
is
like a next level.
It's like
it's true. It's like the actual punishment.
Yeah.
You have to write the little do the little dice shaming thing. This is a difficult question for me because we've been like playing almost exclusively online for years.
Mm.
Got it.
So yeah. It's pretty much you have to roll through the pain because that's how it works.
Actually, I know that Peter from Saving the Game, when playing with Roll 20, gives him bad dice. He'll just roll like 1,000 dice to like reset the algorithm. So
I'm
that's just like grabbing 1,000 new
anything.
Dice. Whether it does or not, it feels better.
yeah, that's true. I guess as long as it feels better.
It's kind of like the cycling equivalent of like spinning up your legs super fast to flush all the lactic acid out of your system so you can keep rolling.
Definitely science. This one really depends, though, on if I'm a GM or if I'm a player.
Okay.
If I'm a player playing with physical dice, I am playing with one specific set of dice, which I refuse to check if they're weighted because I know they probably are because they like me. And then if they start rolling badly, that just means we're on bad terms and we need to work it out as, you know, as a unit. And I'm never putting them down. If I'm a DM, I have a, like, it's just not fair to use those dice. I don't want to do that to my players. So I have a pound of dice that I bought that are just in a giant pouch. And so if some aren't working for me, like, I'll roll them out to start. And if they just really aren't working, then I grab a new D20. It's not even like dice jail. I don't care enough about them. Like, this is, like, is there a better metaphor than a one-night stand who you just never think about again? Because, like, they just go back in the void. They're like, I don't care enough to hate them.
The other thing for me as a GM for the last 2.5-ish years, I've been running masks where the GM doesn't roll. So as a GM, I haven't rolled a die in many a year at this point.
I can't imagine that.
No, like even when we've played online, we've almost always continue to choose to use our real die.
See, when you're using Roll 20, it's just real convenient because if the game has proper Roll 20 integration, you just click a button and then a thing happens.
Sure.
Yeah, but it's not as fun, Grant.
Yeah.
It is not quite as satisfying. I'll concede that, but it's real convenient. Also, like, I feel like when you're playing in an online platform, yeah, you can just have everybody roll their dice, you know, physically on their side and report back what they rolled. And we all trust each other. No one's going to lie or anything like that. But I feel like while there is the unique feeling of actually click-clacking the math rocks and throwing them,
mm-hmm.
there is also the unique experience of when you click the button and you hear the ba-doop in Roll 20 and then everyone gets to react to your roll simultaneously.
It's
yeah.
true.
No, that is fun. I think I haven't played enough on Roll 20 to have fresh experience apart from our current game.
And I think that, like, Grant is also, like, there are a couple other things in play here. It's like before Masks, Grant ran Star Wars, the Fantasy Flight Star Wars
yeah.
game,
uh-huh.
which is just complicated enough that it's way easier to have someone resolving your dice rolls for you.
Sure.
Yeah, because that's like a bunch of different symbols that cancel each other out on
right.
your dice rolls. And
yeah.
I've
played that game in person with physical dice before, and you do get pretty good at picking out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like a huge time slow to do it manually, but
sure.
it is nice to just go click, and then it just lays out what every individual symbol was, but then also tells you what the net result was.
Well, and it takes longer to type out one despair, one, you know, triumph, than it does to type out six.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember the one time that we ended up, or the few sessions that we played in one of the older Star Wars RPG games, I remember distinctly going and finding a dice roller that had Star Wars integration and rolling that on my phone versus physical dice.
Well, and the other thing is now Grant's playing Masks, which is a Powered by the Apocalypse game, so it uses like a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse 2D6. Mm-hmm. So it's less exciting, you know, D20s, and it's more exciting if, you know, you pop it into D20 or to roll 20 and it says hit or oh no.
Yeah, the built-in, at least for Masks, the built-in roll 20 integration, when you roll, it actually drops it in chat as like a comic book speech bubble.
That's awesome.
And it has the big number result when it's either red or green, depending on if it was a success or failure. But then there's a sliding scale. So if you only rolled like a 2, it'll just say, oh no. Or if you roll like a 12 plus, it'll just be like pow in big letters, like Adam West Batman.
That's awesome.
So yeah, it's fun.
I enjoy that. I think I need to play more games on Roll20. I'd gotten in when Roll20 was relatively new, so they didn't have a lot of that. And so I was like, yeah, I mean, it's a thing you can kind of program to do what you want. But it wasn't until we've been playing our game that I'd done much with it.
Yeah.
It was always someone, if we were using it, it was someone else controlling everything and they didn't need us to be logged into it.
Yeah.
I have one set of dice that I really love. They're metal. They're heavy. And I don't mean like they're heavy metal. They're like they're actual metal.
They're cast steel.
Yeah. And I can't bring myself to put them in dice jail because even when they're failing me, they're still too much fun to roll because they just thud when you roll them.
We had to go get you a thick, like old leather-bound
cigar box.
Because you were actually denting our table.
Which it's full of dents anyway. It's the table I grew up with. But yeah, it's pretty incredible. And now I have some like other small sets of plastic dice, which are fine. And I don't mind putting those in dice jail because I don't use them nearly as frequently.
Sure.
But the metal ones, I can never bring myself to put in dice jail. They're too satisfying.
Okay, so dice jail's off the table.
Yeah, and I actually have a proper dice jail.
You do.
A little wooden foldable. It's cute.
But never use it.
I just don't really use it all that frequently.
Okay.
Well, at least it gets to go in the cute dice jail.
Yeah. It's not being punished.
Is that like the episode of Parks and Rec where she goes to jail, but she gets put in jail in Eagleton?
Yes.
And so it's like the really nice lockup.
Yep. That's exactly
what
it's like.
Where they give you a gift basket on the way out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's like. It's just going into its quiet space. It needs to cool off.
It still has light. It still has everything else. It's not like you're just shoving it into a dark hole and never see the light of day again.
Yep. Nope. It's just there sitting in the corner.
I think we may have accidentally walked into a metaphor about prison reform here.
A little bit. A little bit.
Beware the dice industrial complex.
Yep. Oh, gosh.
Do you find that your dice are better equipped to reintegrate into society after coming out of that dice jail, Ashley? Is it more of a dice rehabilitation center where they learn how to roll more productively?
It is. We have a lot of really great programs. A lot of really great programs. We have a Shakespeare behind bars situation. It's really great.
Is it a low rate of? Do you have a low rate of dice recidivism?
We do.
We're very proud. Too much tragedy was why they're in dice jail in the first place.
We don't want to talk about that. It's fine. Kyle, what about you?
You also didn't give a full answer. You gave the one thing that you don't do.
Oh no! So I roll through the pain more often.
Roll
than
through
not.
The pain.
Yeah.
Okay.
I also tend to roll through the pain, mostly because I still end up DMing more than I play, usually 5th edition.
Mm-hmm.
And like I just have a set of different colors of dice, and I tend to kind of color code it to help me keep track of things when I'm like doing combat and stuff. So I'll have like, okay, the bugbear is the purple die, and the goblin is the red die, and the, you know, just so I can keep track of myself, because with everything else going on, I always get myself confused.
Yeah.
So it's basically a non-option of just powering through, because all of my dice are pre-assigned to something and I don't want to end up screwing up my system. So And even as a player, most of the time, I like to go with whatever colored set of dice fits the aesthetic of my character.
I get
which
that.
Which is ridiculous, but it's what I do.
Nah.
I get it.
Yeah. I know for me, I will banish die. Like, I have multiple sets. I have 4 or 5 sets of less. I'm very particular on my dice. Like, I don't want frilly. I just want standard single color.
Yeah, so he's got, like, a white set, a yellow set, an orange. They're like traffic cones.
Yeah, it's just, I like simple, just clean color dies. And if
it's
they
like
start
construction site.
If they start failing me, I will take it out of rotation. I will just chuck it back in the box and be like, and you're done for the night, whether I'm DMing or not. Though, I haven't DM'd in a long time, but my favorite die for DMing is actually downstairs on the gaming shelf, because I have one of those, like, 4x size, the one that's about the size of a baseball, that's a D20, and I love using that when it feels like my players, I'm losing attention, or like they're getting so into the weeds with RP or something that they're not taking the moment seriously. So then I'll just casually roll that, and there is no subtle way to roll that die. It just suddenly is on the table, and they know, oh no, something has transpired. So yeah, I banish.
I
banish
see,
dice.
I think failure is far more interesting a lot of the time.
Sure.
In tabletop role playing. So I don't even really mind when I fail. I mean, yeah, in certain key moments it's frustrating, but with the right DM I feel like it can go in particularly hilarious or at least compelling directions.
For sure. I don't mind failure. Like, hear me when I say I don't mind failure when it's like good, like it makes a really interesting narrative point. But if there comes a time in a session where all I'm doing is rolling terribly to the point where it's not fun and I'm not doing anything.
Yeah.
That's when I'm like, okay, I need to rotate something out.
Sure.
Because this is no longer fun for me and I'm not helping the team, nor am I enjoying myself. So let's actually change a variable to see if that helps at all.
Sure.
Even if it's completely
subjective.
Yeah,
when you're no longer contributing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's funny that you two mentioned failure being interesting and something that should be possibly incentivized when it's for the good of the story. Because that's a major mechanic in Powered by the Apocalypse.
Really? Okay. So let's get into that then. Paige and Grant are here to talk about Powered by the Apocalypse games. And because they've, I think, of all our friends.
I love that at this point, that's the introduction we get. It's like Paige and Grant are here.
Yeah. Well, they know you.
I mean, Paige and Grant from technically nothing now.
Yeah.
From the void of podcast
Paige and
space.
Grant, who live in an apartment and go to work sometimes.
Let's be fair. You've been on our show so many times. You may as well just be like technical honorary co-hosts whenever we need other people.
Podcast cousins.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Born around the same
time.
Yeah,
Gilmore
Balsy
did end over spring.
Yeah.
But yeah, so do you want me to just finish my thought then, now that we've introduced the topic?
May as well.
Oh no, I cut Ashley off. I was a
Oh, that's true.
You can cut
that. That's true. I'm sorry. Do you want to finish your intro?
Yes, let her intro.
No, this is all staying in. I have no further intro. There are friends. If you don't know them by now, then you're the
Also, hi, this is episode 188 episode of the MinMax podcast. There we go. Official intro over.
You should have jumped in earlier.
Nope.
So Powered by the Apocalypse, for our listeners who aren't familiar, is it is a system umbrella in the same way that like D20 is a system umbrella that envelops 13th Age and a bunch of other games.
One of them is called D&D.
One of them's called D&D, sure. All right. It originally, the reason it's called Powered by, it's actually funny, Powered by the Apocalypse is, it's a complete nonsense name that doesn't mean anything. Because what does that actually mean? Nothing. How can you be powered by the... No, nobody knows. The reason it's called that is because it originated with a game called Apocalypse World, which was just sort of your usual kind of Mad Max. Yeah, okay. Mad Max, Borderlands, post-apoc setting. And then people were like, hey, this system actually works really well, and started spinning it out to other genres. And it is full, up front, the only Powered by the Apocalypse game that Paige and I, unless there's something I'm forgetting about Paige's history, that Paige and I have actually played is one called Masks. Masks, A New Generation, which is specifically a teen superhero setting.
Okay.
It is for if you want to play a group of moody teenage superheroes in a world where there are adult heroes and you're trying to find your place in the world. So it's your Teen Titans, your Young Justice, your Runaways. It is my firm belief, I think Masks is one of the best tabletop systems ever. It is easily my favorite tabletop system I've ever run. It really captures the tone and the genre that it's going for perfectly.
But just to roll back for a second, though, what Powered by the Apocalypse means.
The kind of trappings of it, right? Unless, I don't know, you explain what you mean by that so that I don't put words in your mouth.
So, Powered by the Apocalypse, there are enough games in it that don't use any one of these things that it's hard to define. Because most Powered by the Apocalypse games use 2d6, two six-sided dice as their resolution mechanic. Some don't. A lot of them use a tiered system for that, where there's, you know, a full hit is like 10 to 12 plus, a partial hit is a 7 to 9, and anything 6 or below is a failure. Like, that's a partial hit is a failure with, or a success with a complication, and anything below that is a failure. And a lot of, like, the other thing that defines them is that they use moves, which are things that both the players and the GM can do, that are a very strictly set out list of things that can be done, which sounds very restrictive, but it's not. We can get there.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is they are very narrative forward. Games like D&D are pretty simulationist, or where you have a lot of different stats and crunches to make sure you can simulate what it would be like to be an elf in a fantasy world who decided to steal 16 jars for no apparent reason. Brendan, why are you doing that? But Powered by the Apocalypse is very much like when you go into combat, there's no real shift. Like, there's a little bit of shift into combat, but there's no initiative tracker. There's no map.
Formalized combat rules whatsoever.
You just narrate what's going on and you use these move mechanics, but it's mostly a cinematic viewpoint.
Yeah.
And for any Powered by the Apocalypse game, you can find one that doesn't do any of those things, but that's the general definition. The one other thing is that the games are very strictly genred. You know, one thing people say about D&D, and this is contentious, is that D&D can kind of be moved to be used for anything. I don't like doing that, but some people love trying to tweak D&D until it can be whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. There was this period in the 2000s where it was like, we're going to make a D20 for everything. Like, hey guys, look, it's Naruto D20. And it's like, why are you doing this? D20 is good at a very specific set of things.
Mm-hmm.
But there was just this thing where it was like, we're going to make everything D20, even if it doesn't fit at all. To the point where, like, the dominant Star Wars system for a while was Star Wars D20. And, like, I'm sorry, D20 is terrible for Star Wars. It's a terrible choice. It doesn't work at all. That's my rant. Anyway.
No, but unpack that a little bit, because I think a lot of people who are new to tabletop role playing, they're most familiar with D20 systems. So for you, when you say it doesn't fit Star Wars, what do you mean by that?
I think that this might be a controversial statement to people who got started with like 5e and a lot of the newer D20 stuff.
I welcome the hate mail.
D20 is not good at being cinematic.
Okay.
It's just not. D20 does not support cinematic combat. D20 does not support cinematic set pieces very well, in most cases. And so, because, like Paige said, it's so simulationist, there's, and you know, obviously you could go further down that line because it's nowhere near as simulationist as some other crunchier systems, but it is still relatively on the simulationist side. There's, it's hard to explain, but it's very much in the nitty gritty and the moment to moment of everything. And it's ultimately pretty, it's not as interested in being, heroic all the time and being as, yeah, I guess I keep going back to the word cinematic. Like, if you look at Star Wars, right? So that's an example that a lot of people are familiar with. So we can talk about how that doesn't quite fit,
okay.
Right? The
if you're not, go back to Min-Max's entire series on Star Wars.
Right. So, like, the usual magic systems that are baked into how well D20 works is just fundamentally incompatible with how the Force works, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, your usual Vancian magic spell slots, all that BS, just does not compute when you try to translate it to the Force, which is a really important part of Star Wars' aesthetic, right?
Mm-hmm.
D20 was built to specifically be for D&D, for, okay, you are swords and sorcery, crawling through dungeons, slaying monsters, and taking their loot.
Mm-hmm.
It was not built for character dramas. It was not built for, you know, anything that is more melodramatic or something sort of space opera-y like Star Wars, right? Which I know that's not quite, but you know what I mean, right? It wasn't built for those things. And so one of my pet peeves about, one of my pet peeves with 5e is that a lot of people are like, run it to play those kinds of games. And sure, you can, but there are a lot of other systems that could handle those sorts of themes better.
Well, and one other thing about Star Wars specifically, like just to kind of give more of a feel for it, is that Star Wars doesn't really operate on a success or failure, just like a single axis of success or failure.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say, you know, Luke Skywalker is trying to get through a door. He's being, you know, chased by stormtroopers. In D&D, like, if you roll, then a success, like, would be you get through the door. Great. You know, you escape the stormtroopers. But when Fantasy Flight Games decided to make a Star Wars system, what they looked at when they saw Star Wars is, like, usually there are multiple things happening at once in any scene. Like, yes, they might have succeeded at doing the thing, but then a threat was added. You know, they get through the door, but the stormtroopers hit an alarm and more stormtroopers are coming from the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And a good DM can do that. Like, a good DM playing 5e can do that, where if they see, you know, you got, like, a 12 and their target number was 15, then maybe they would do that. But that's not baked into the rules, and so that's something a GM has to bring to the table themselves and, like, hack in.
Mm-hmm.
While a system that's specifically built for Star Wars, like the Fantasy Flight, has a double axis of, like, success and failure, but also advantage and threat, where you can say yes, but, or no, or, you know, it's a yes, but, or no, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
where you can have that kind of more complicated mechanic.
Yeah, and so D20 is going for a very specific feel, and if you're playing for a campaign in a genre that matches that feel, then great, but, like, there are so many things that don't have that feel. I think jumping into masks specifically can really explain that. The thing, sorry, I bumped my mic, let me say that again. Jumping into masks specifically can really help illustrate that, because the thing that masks handles really well that is a problem that comes up often in other superhero games, whether it be D20 stuff that tries to emulate superheroes, or even like Mutants and Masterminds and those other kinds of specifically superhero engines, is, you know, you have the Hawkeye Thor problem, right? Of how do you balance your encounters when you've got characters on the same team that are of such widely different power levels?
Sure.
And how do you make that interesting? Because superhero teams aren't balanced. Like, they're just not. They're not. The superhero genre is not balanced. And part of what makes it fun is that superhero teams are all these different people from totally different origins, totally different walks of life, and differently equipped who are all able to contribute to do these amazing things.
Yeah.
So because combat is entirely narratively driven, it gives the GM a lot more license to work around that. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you were to try to do, okay, you want to stat the Avengers in let's say 5e, right? If you want to do that in a way that is not either nerfing Thor to the level where he doesn't really match what his counterpart's supposed to be, or buffing Hawkeye to the point where it doesn't make any sense and it's ridiculous, you're going to run into the problem of just like, okay, if we really want to look at let's say we're going by the MCU because most people know, you want to actually look at the evidence there, what's Thor's strength score versus Hawkeye's? Let's be real. It's ridiculous, right? Yeah. It doesn't work. And so as a GM, you just can't make that work without taking some pretty extreme license to the point where you're not even really running the genre anymore.
Okay.
In Masks, and in most Powered by the Apocalypse, you do still have hit points, but it's just like a harm track, right? Mm-hmm. Where you mark a box of harm and whatever. Because most Powered by the Apocalypse, you are playing people who are at a relatively similar power level. But because it's such a flexible system, and Masks is able to take that license to match the genre it's going for, you don't have hit points in Masks. If you take physical damage, that's just narrative. It's like, okay, whatever, who cares? What matters is you have 5 conditions you can take, and those are emotional conditions you can have inflicted upon you. So you can be afraid, angry, guilty, hopeless, or insecure as a result of something that happens.
Because you're a teenager trying to fight crime.
Right.
Yeah, you're a teenager trying to fight crime. And whichever one of those that you take gives you a debuff to one of your to one of your core stats. And so then that makes it harder for you to do a certain thing, and then it can be cleared in a certain way. So if you're angry, you're not going to be as good at piercing the mask, which is sort of reading someone's intentions.
Okay.
And you're not going to be as good at comforting or supporting someone because you're angry. You can clear that either by having somebody comfort or support you, so, you know, they help you sort through that anger and you're fine now. Or each condition has a specific thing you can do. So for anger, it's break something important.
Mm.
And that can be literal or metaphorical, like snapping at your best friend on the team so that they get frustrated with you and walk off in a huff. You can clear angry now because you broke something important. You broke that relationship.
Yeah.
And even from that, you can tell that, like, instead of the, like, how I am at a combatant, which is really what D&D is tracking a lot of the time. You know, you've got your HP, you've got your strength, you've got your spells.
Yeah.
This is really tracking who are you as a human being right now and how are you relating to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, sort of quickly illustrating in practice with that example, right? Let's say it wouldn't be Masks because that's supposed to specifically be teenagers, but whatever, roll with me.
Yeah.
Let's say I'm using Masks to run an Avengers game, right? Okay, you know, Kyle, you're playing as Hawkeye. You're fighting Thanos. You're like, I'm going to go up to Thanos and deck him in the schnoz, right? For one, normally, if we're running a purely simulationist thing, that's a terrible idea, because if you're playing as Hawkeye, you're not going to run up to Thanos and deck him in the schnoz. But the directly engage a threat move, the way it works is, depending on how you roll, you can select a certain number of options from a list, and one of those options is take something important from them. So, you can specifically even say, I'm gonna go try to take the gauntlet off his hand. All right, cool. Roll it. You roll. You fail. In a, you know, if we're running this in D20, okay, Kyle, start rolling up a new character.
Right.
But running it in Masks, yeah, okay, theoretically, it would just be, boom, crunch, Hawkeye's dead. But I, as the GM, know death isn't interesting, and mechanically speaking, you're not at the point where you'd even be taken out of the fight yet. So I have to creatively problem solve this. So you run up and, you know, shoot a couple arrows and then try to get close to him, whatever. He bats the arrows aside, he catches your fist, and he looks you in the eyes, and he's like, you're not even worth my time, and, you know, compares you to an insect, and tosses you over his shoulder, and you land in the rubble. And that makes you angry. So now you're angry, right? Whereas then, say, you know, like, Alan, you're playing as Thor, and you do the same thing. You're like, okay, I'm going to run up to him and just, I'm going to go for the head this time. You roll, you fail.
I don't believe this world where Alan is not playing as Captain America, but continue.
good point, but, you know, roll with it here. You roll, you fail. I can have a little more fun. I can have him be like, okay, he's gonna choke slam you, and if people, you know, a block away feel the shockwave.
Sure.
It still makes you angry. Mechanically speaking, it's the same consequence, but I can. It gives me more freedom as the GM to infuse the flavor of the genre into it.
Gotcha.
And Powered by the Apocalypse does a really good job of conforming to that.
And it's actually pretty cool because people have used that to be a large, like, scale of different genres. I think the Powered by the Apocalypse game that's most famous because the Adventure Zone did it is Monster of the Week, which is, like, Supernatural, Buffy, that kind of thing. Masks as Teen Superheroes. There's Glitter Hearts that's, like, your Sailor Moon Magical Girls. But there's also, like, coming out Pasión de Pasiones, which is telenovelas. I just found out yesterday there's one called Mashed, which you just happen to be medics in the Korean War. Like, there is kind of anything. I know.
Wow.
We need that one bad.
Because it's not specifically, you know, a combat simulator like a lot of tabletop games ultimately are, you can do stuff like that. Which is really cool. And, like, I think the engine that really helps move that is the moves system, which is just, like, when you do a thing in the narrative that matches a certain criteria, then the dice system is engaged. And so the moves are different from system to system, which helps you kind of codify, okay, these are the tools that usually... that are usually used in the genre we're trying to emulate to move the plot forward.
And it's really interesting to see that difference between different genres, because, like, here I have Masks, and, you know, one of the moves is Unleash Your Powers. But the moves are really named based on what, like, the moves are also supposed to give a feel for what you're doing. I've talked... actually hear about Bluebeard's Bride before, the horror one shot. And one of your moves there is Caress the Horror. And, like, you can see how different the systems are, even just looking at the moves. Because in Masks, it's like, okay, you know, if things go well, you can, like, knock an enemy out of battle, or you can take something from them, or you can provide an opportunity for your allies. It's all about working together and being powerful. But looking at something called, like, Bluebeard's Bride, where it's supposed to be about trauma and horror, they even have, like, your health system is a trauma tracker. All of the moves pretty much that you can do come at a cost to the player. And so all of the moves are built to take power away from the player, while in Masks they're built to give power to the player. And so it is just very focused on how do we make you feel like you're in the genre, and using that to encourage people to role play what the genre is.
Yeah, it's very much, Powered by the Apocalypse in general is very much about giving the players tools to encourage and build their role play. I know there's a bit of a debate in a lot of D20 circles about, like, you know, taking like 4E as an example. D&D 4th edition, there was a lot of talk of, like, D&D 4th edition was just a combat simulator and didn't have any roleplay.
Yeah.
And then people who defend 4th edition are like, well, okay, yeah, technically it didn't have built-in roleplay mechanics, but there was literally nothing stopping you from also making it roleplay heavy and having the rules to back it up. And, you know, my take on that is that both are valid, and also 5e has the exact same thing, where 5e really doesn't have a whole lot of roleplay mechanics. It has those little boxes in the corner of your character sheet of, like, your bonds and your flaws or whatever, and that's it. And from there, it just says, figure it out, nerd. And if you're already a really strong role player, like I've played with all of you here, you're all already really strong role players. And so that doesn't slow you all down one bit. You can just go roll with it, and you can play a 5e game that's really high RP, and it works, and it's great, and it's fun and awesome. But for new players who, you know, maybe don't have things like acting or improv experience to help back that up, it can be really, really challenging. And, like, I've seen that with my regular group that I've been running since we graduated from college.
Yeah.
Like, we started in first edition Pathfinder. And the roleplay was basically non-existent for the first half of that campaign because everyone was so bogged down in the rules.
Sure.
Excuse me. Jenny Tequila stabbed things. That was her character.
That was her character. And she invented tacos.
She stabbed things and had a leopard named Marbles. Like, I took this seriously.
Jenny Tequila.
Yeah. Yep, she invented tacos before Critical Role made that joke.
No, it was Adventure Zone, I think.
Adventure Zone, whatever. I don't care. I don't get actual plays. Like, I just don't. Like, if you enjoy them, more power to you, but I've tried, and I just, like, I don't understand the appeal of this. So they're all the same. They're all just Critical Role.
That's gonna get you the emails.
Yeah, well, like last night when I said all baseball movies are the same.
Oh.
Yeah, he was like, oh, the one with the ghost, isn't that League of Their Own? It's like, no.
Like, League of Their Own, that's the one where he builds a thing to meet his dad, right?
No.
and then the coach really wants them to fail, so they decide they're gonna win the whole thing, and then the angels help them out. That's League of Their Own, right? In case y'all haven't noticed, I'm occasionally purposely belligerent. Anyway, what was I even saying? Yeah, so we played Pathfinder, and like because we were a group that didn't have those foundational skills to build on, we really struggled with the roleplay element. And then we played Star Wars, which provides a little more scaffolding for it, and it got better and got better and got better. Now we're playing Masks. We've had a couple sessions in a row where there are like two dice rolls, and it's just like all roleplay.
Mm-hmm.
And even like, I mean, as a comparison, the first time you ran Masks, you were running with a group of people from your high school. And, like, all of them kind of knew each other, and some of them had played together. I hadn't played with any of them. And, you know, you hadn't seen them too much since high school. And we were running Masks, and so it was really easy to just get into character. And because one other thing that's a really good strength about Masks specifically, but some other, like, Powered by the Apocalypse systems, is that the playbooks that are, like, basically equivalent to classes like Fighter or Sorcerer or, you know, whatever in D&D, they are mostly, like, they are based on a character archetype. Mm-hmm. So a Fighter, like, could be a dozen things. Like, I mean, technically a Knight's probably a Paladin, but you could make a Knight Fighter. You could make, you know... I'm not giving examples, but Fighter doesn't really tell you about anything about who this person is. They like to stab things sometimes, and that's how they make their money. Maybe they're noble, maybe they're terrible, maybe they have, you know, a home and family who they love, maybe they are hopeless. And it's a really wide open box where you can put anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, and that's great for somebody who's a really confident role player, but in Masks, the playbooks aren't actually tied to powers. Like, you don't say, I want to be a speedster, so I choose the speedster playbook. You know, I want to be the Flash, so I pick that. Instead, it's like, what is your character's problem? Like, if you walked, like what is your deal? And so, like, you could be a beacon where you don't have powers, but you just really want to be a superhero and you're worried you don't belong here. Or you could be a transformed something, you know. Something is horrific about how you appear, but you really want to fit in with this world. It could be that you are a Nova. You're very, 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 very powerful. What your powers are doesn't matter. It could be ice powers. It could be psychic powers. Doesn't matter. What matters is that you have to keep yourself in check all the time and figure out what that means as a teenager who's trying to figure out your life.
Got it.
Okay.
And so with even just a brand new role player, when you come into a role, like, I was talking to a friend from work and she was like, she's playing a 5e campaign and she's like a former assassin. And it sounded like a really cool backstory where she's a dragonborn former assassin who accidentally like got a hit for somebody she knew and, you know, now has to deal, like decided to leave the life, you know. Mm-hmm. And she's like, that's great. I love that backstory. But when I get there in the game, I don't know how to connect that with what I'm doing, especially because I don't know how to use my criminal background without feeling like an antisocial jerk.
Sure.
Meanwhile, like you come to Masks as, you know, a doomed, which is one of the like edgy baby playbooks where it's just like, you have your doom coming for you. It's like Raven from Teen Titans.
Yeah.
Where something big is coming for you. you know that's coming. The DM knows that's coming. You both know the exact story you want to tell, and it's just a matter of figuring out the specifics and how to make it unique and flavored to your voice. And so even coming in with these, like, people who I didn't know that well, it was really easy to gel as a party and make interesting stories together.
And the other thing is that the playbooks also come with their own moves, which is really helpful in giving you an idea of not only how to play your character, but how your character archetype can help interact with the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there's the legacy playbook, which is you're just the next one in a long line of superheroes with that name, right? You're Kid Flash, or you're one of the later Robins, or something like that.
Yeah.
And so you've got all your basic stuff for directly engaging and unleashing your powers, comforting, supporting somebody, all that stuff, but you also have moves specific to you. So, like, you have one called Symbol of Authority. So when you try to tell an NPC what to do based on an authority that they recognize, there's a specific role you can do that gives you specific options to help you change the story in a unique way. So, you know, oh, we're doing, like, there's a supervillain's gone crazy in the city and, you know, there's a building on fire. And so you point to, like, there's a cop who's responding, and you say, hey, you, get people on the scene to get people out of that building. I'm going to go after him, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess kind of like that scene in the original Avengers movie, right, where Cap lands on top of the cop car and starts ordering people around, right?
Yeah.
And so you're just some teenager, but because you're the legacy, the symbol on your chest matches a hero that they know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, okay, they don't know you, but they know what you're wearing. Like, they know that symbol. Do they recognize you as someone worth listening to? And so you roll, and if you hit, you can choose. They either do what you say, they get out of your way in, you know, in some way, shape, or form. Like, if you're using it against somebody who's against you, or they just freeze. Like, there's a couple options you can use for if you're using it on an antagonistic force.
Mm-hmm. I love how you say that, like, the power of Batman compels you.
I mean, kind of. I mean, kind of, right? Like, that's a thing. So there's stuff like that. Or, like, they have another one that's just, like, you know, when you go to one of your elders for advice, tell them a problem you're facing, ask them a question about that problem. There's no role tied to that one. It's just a thing you can do at any time, is go to them for advice, and then they'll tell you their honest answer and tell you what they think you should do. So if you do what they, if you follow their advice, you get a +1 to any move you make that's following that advice. But if you go against what they tell you and chart your own path, you get to mark potential, which is the XP tracker. Basically, you get XP if you go against their advice.
Interesting.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But even to give a feel for that, so Legacy comes into battle and is like, hey, I am the Flash. Listen to me. Meanwhile, there's another playbook that I'm playing right now, actually, the Scion, which is like the daughter or the child of a supervillain, like an honest-to-goodness biological child of a supervillain.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone knows that that's who you are. And so while a legacy goes onto a field and says, hey, listen to me, the Scion has a move called I'll Show Them, where you defend someone who doesn't believe in you, and you can take, you know, like, you get their trust and respect. And so one person comes into battle and says, hey, I already have authority here. And another says, I have to earn that authority. And so your approach to combat will look completely different based on what kind of character you decided to play.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. These examples are really helpful because I admittedly have been for a long time like, well, yeah, you can role play in any game. You know, you can have RP
and you
in
can.
Any game, right? Well, right, and you can, but what was helpful was Grant complimenting us and saying we were good at it to give a distinction between, you know, those players who are comfortable with role playing, because not everybody is, and really going for it in scenes, as opposed to people who would, as you said, need the scaffolding to be able to understand how that would function within a game.
Yeah.
That wasn't something I was always understanding or appreciating, because I'm extra in every game I play. It doesn't matter.
You're just that good, so you didn't notice that other people might not be.
No, it's not so much.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's not so much that. It's that I was the kid who, in playing chess, would make character and relationship plots between all of the pieces uh-huh. in chess because I didn't understand why I would want to play a game that didn't have drama involved.
No, I understand. I had playing cards.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
They put
you
faces
get it.
On them. What did they expect us to do?
Right. Exactly. But this is really helpful in understanding these kinds of mechanics a lot better. Do you find that when you introduce these more roleplay heavy mechanics to new groups of players that they respond well to them, or does it take them a while to kind of adapt to that system?
I mean, obviously everybody's different, but I've found in general that people do respond well to it. I mean, like, in my main group that I've been running, like, we've gotten comfortable with each other because we've been playing for so long, and so there was a lot more roleplay in, like, even our Star Wars campaign, but as soon as we made the jump into Masks, the level of role playing leveled up rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I had one of my players. She's playing one of my favorite playbooks called The Harbinger, where your whole deal is you've come from a horrible future to prevent it. So you have a whole mechanic around, but like the time travel process scrambled your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't remember exactly what causes the horrible future, which is great because it allows you to do a game that's all about preventing the future without having to lock in the event so you can still make it an improv-heavy game.
Okay.
But anyway, she's playing that, and so we talked a little bit about, like, okay, so what kind of future is it, and, like, you know, what's your deal and everything. And, like, week two of the campaign, I got a message from her that was just like, Grant, help me. I'm invested.
Oh no.
Yeah, like she was the player, you know, by no means was she like a disengaged player before, but she was definitely the player who would you know, be a little more timid about role playing, would struggle a little bit to find her voice in the individual scene even when she had a strong concept for her character.
Yeah.
But now, like, she still sometimes is the person who's happy to kind of fade into the background for a session, and she's fine with that. But she's really, really engaged when she's engaged. And, like, she's the one who's keeping meticulous notes about what happened every session.
Okay.
And, like, is maintaining the NPC codex to keep track of who everybody is and, like, what their powers are and their civilian name and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And is, like, really, really invested in it now.
Okay.
But the funny thing is, you say that, but between, like, we're not talking about the forgotten game, which is between Star Wars and Masks, we tried to do L5R. We tried to play Legends of the Five Rings.
Okay.
Which is a, basically, it's pseudo-Japanese, kind of mixed up all of Asia. You know, there are plenty of people with plenty of opinions on how that works. Who can talk about that more intelligently than I can. But basically, like, if you want to play a Kurosawa movie with some fantasy flair, then you go to Legend of the Five Rings.
Okay.
It's Samurai Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
Complete with a great big wall along one of the borders of the nation that's keeping zombies out on the other end.
That's,
yep.
I'm very into this aesthetic.
You would
and
be.
And we all were too. We were,
it's
like,
a really
this
cool
sounds
setting.
Really cool. But when we tried to play it, like, there are so many trappings of a culture that isn't ours. And I don't even necessarily mean this is accurate Japanese culture. This is, like, this is the culture of Rokugan,
mm-hmm.
where it's, like, it's all about honor. It's all about, you know, doing the thing that follows the code of Bushido. And so a lot of the time, like, and I've played good games of L5R that, you know, where it comes more easily because the person is a more comfortable DM mm-hmm. in that setting. Because when we played the first time, it was a different edition of L5R, and it was with a game of all GMs and our friend Kyle, not to be confused with this Kyle. He's really into role playing and Star Wars, but also likes tech. That's the one defining factor.
The other Kyle would never be found dead in a room full of small children.
That's also true.
Got it.
Yeah, he's
actually no. If he was in a room full of small children, that's how he's found dead.
True. Yeah. This Kyle's job would not play well with the other Kyle. Anyway.
But he is very much into assassin.
I don't know.
No, he just really doesn't like
no,
kids.
No, actually, technically, he's a white hat hacker.
Oh,
it's
cool.
Really sweet.
He just really doesn't like kids.
Got it.
No. But when, like, he is very much into, like, that is his genre, and so he flowed into it very easily. And, like, Grant loves his samurai movies, but at the same time, like, it wasn't something that he slotted into running as easily.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And we as players weren't quite sure what to do either, because it was easy to see all like the, when you're playing L5R, well, the really cool thing is that you can't go to combat immediately. Like if you think that the queen is secretly a zombie in disguise, you can't go and slaughter her in the court because then you'd probably, you know, have to trigger warning, commit suicide for your honor.
That'll definitely start with Sep and end in Uku.
Okay.
And so you have to find another way to do it. Violence can't be the answer, and you have to think in a very tactical manner to stay within your honor code.
Got it. Okay.
And when that goes well, that creates really interesting games that are really different than 5e.
Yeah.
Than you know, like fantasy D20 genres. But when like the group doesn't know what they're doing as well, those role play trappings get really trapping. Like you feel constricted because all you see are the things you can't do and shouldn't do. And you don't know how much you're allowed to do in the game without like it adversely affecting you too much.
Yeah. Okay.
Because you're in this system straitjacket.
Yeah.
And so, like, you can, like, adding roleplay trappings can be really, really good. And I think in Masks, like, that's a great example of when it's good. But when it's not implemented correctly, it can just feel like more things you have to keep track of. And it makes it harder to roleplay instead of easier.
Okay.
Got it.
What would you say is easier to transition into a D20 system to a more roleplay mechanic heavy system or vice versa?
I mean, I've never done vice versa, so it's hard to say.
Although, I mean, I think the thing that's like I've seen for Grant, and this is like will change from individual to individual, is that the more like when we started playing, you were running exclusively Pathfinder. You were maybe like you thought about running Mutants and Masterminds once, but you ran a lot of really crunchy systems.
At the time, that was all I knew.
Right.
At the time, it was all you knew. And, like, we slowly transitioned to Star Wars, then to Masks, like, and then you know, ran some Masks with our other group. And we kind of got to, like, I started running 13th Age, which is D20, but it is still a little bit less crunchy and a little more roleplay forward. And at this point, like, Grant has said he's never going to run anything with a grid ever again, so he refuses to make that transition back.
Mm.
So for you, at least, like, story game to, you know, fantasy D20 is the harder transition, and you've said you're only going to do it with 13th Age.
Yeah, my next campaign after Masks is going to be 13th Age, and I am fairly confident 13th Age is the only fantasy D20 game I'm ever going to run, or you know, something more like it from here out. Yeah.
And I think the thing that's hard is that a lot of people do D&D first.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing, like, once again, there is nothing wrong with D&D. And, like, lots of people love it, lots of people have fun, but there are some people who, like, adapt D&D to everything specifically because, like, not everyone who adapts it to everything. Some people just love a D20.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some people who are like, I don't want to learn another system. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be hard. I'm going to have to learn, like, a fatty book. And it's because D&D is the first thing most of us experience, and it trains us to expect this very rules-heavy, system-heavy system.
Yeah.
it, you know, trains us to expect that if you start buying, you're going to need 3 books just to start, and then you're going to keep buying supplements and splat books.
Right.
And then, meanwhile, like, our, you know, like, our group has been playing Lady Blackbird, which is free, or, you know, pay what you want, and 12 pages long. And to some people, that's not going to be a good fit. But for some people who think that the only thing that exists is something that's as hard to learn as D&D, like, if you think that, like, you see, you know, someone says, hey, you want to play Lady Blackbird, and you're like, no, I cannot learn another system. I guarantee, in this case, you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So sometimes I think the difficulty from moving from D&D to a system like this is just you have so many expectations for what that's going to look like, mm-hmm. because that's the only thing you know.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
One of the things, just on observation based on what you guys are saying, that I think at least is true for me and is maybe true for others out there as well, is I think when you're starting with something like D&D, because it's so crunchy, the mechanics of it are so well defined in terms of this is kind of what your character can do or not do. This is what it is to be a fighter. This is what it is to be a wizard or whatever. Whereas with more roleplay heavy systems, it's a little more open-ended, which I think is why having that extra guidance is really helpful, but I think it can also be a little bit more intimidating for, mm-hmm. you know, because I tend to be a rather mechanically minded person naturally, right? Like the sciencey side of things, like give me the crunch, give me the numbers, to just help me understand how it works.
Yeah.
He's appealing to me at the forefront, but ultimately I want to get to a point where, you know, like when we play together, even, you know, the last couple times we've done recordings with Jeff Romo, there mm-hmm. have been so many sessions where I'm like, I don't even remember us picking up dice, just because that's where we naturally tend to go, right? And so I feel like there's maybe something of a personality balance there for people who are wired like me, who maybe like to have the numbers and the crunch to kind of guide them into shaping the rules of the universe, whereas on the flip side, other people are going to come at it from a role-playing side and want to have the guidance to be able to figure out, like they're not necessarily naturally thinking through character motivations and things in the same way, and so it's helpful for them to come into it and be able to have kind of guidance to you know, really understand, like, okay, this is what it takes to make a compelling character.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. They're like, you know, let's say you're on a forest, you know, you're in a forest, there are like 5 orcs attacking you. If you're playing D&D, it's really easy to say, oh, I have a sword, I swipe, you know, like it's easy to know what you're doing and you've optimized right. for this moment. You are here and you are ready. But if you're playing, you know, like, you know, my character in the Masks game is a witch, and that's technically not in the rules anywhere that, you know, that's what the playbook is built for. I have to make up every time what she can and can't do.
Yeah, there's no spell list.
Yeah.
There's no spell list. So I have to think, like, am I going to hit them with a fireball? Am I going to make, you know, do a druid thing where the vines come alive and, like, tie up the orcs? And that freedom can be really nice for some people, but I can see how that's crazy intimidating.
I mean, it was right. intimidating for you at the beginning of the campaign.
Oh, yeah.
I remember at the beginning...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I remember at the beginning of the campaign, like, you telling me, like, it sometimes it's hard to know what to do with my powers because magic is such a broad thing and I don't want to step on anybody else's toes with their more niche powers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, like, specifically even now, like, we have, you know, a time traveler who does portals, so I will not do, like, I'm not messing with anything interdimensional. We have a fire, like, a guy who does fire and ice and wind. Like, I'm not doing anything elemental. Like, just, like, very careful to not step onto someone else's square.
How do you keep track of the constraints or the limits that you have on your own your character's magic?
I don't.
Yeah, it's comic books, right? Like, there's whatever, like a superhero's powers vary depending on what the story needs them to be able to do in the issue, mm-hmm. right? Like, how much can Superman lift? Exactly as much as he needs to be able to lift to make sure that there's still some drama.
Sure.
And so breaking out of that sort of simulationist mindset gives you a lot more freedom to just do whatever is most dramatically appropriate.
Like in this case, her powers have been everything from bringing a Ferris wheel to life to making black holes. Sure, why not? It was interesting this week.
Sure. I think because we've had so many conversations.
I also realized what drives some people crazy.
Yeah, right. Well, because I'm thinking about it, and we've had so many conversations in the past about magic systems and how much, you know, crap people dump on, and there are plenty of reasonable critiques for this, but like the magic system in Harry Potter or the magic system in Lord of the Rings versus other magic systems that have far more like strict guidelines.
Actual thought.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That I find it interesting that in those arenas, people get nitpicky about it. But when it comes to role playing, whatever's sort of dramatically appropriate, that's fine, and no one really questions it. Because I happen to find them to be the same people.
Yeah,
I think it depends.
I think like it's a couple things where. For one thing, the main concern when you're going into something that's like a, because there are probably some people who would worry about the magic systems and making sure they make sense. I don't tend to play with those people. No offense.
Little did you know.
Or at least, or I don't tend to play games where it doesn't matter with people because it's like it's fun to get your session zero, get your shared consent about what the world's going to be.
Yeah.
But for one thing, it's a superhero game. Like, if it was a purely magic game, I would probably want to have my magic system more in line. But, like, there's magic, there's space aliens, there's time travel. At some point, we got a devil in there. Like, we're not keeping track of all these things separately. Like,
next
one
arc,
of our players,
next arc,
you can
might fight more vampires.
Ooh.
You can see one of the player's heart break a little bit every time travel comes up because she really wants it to be a logical time travel system when we're like, you just built a time baseball to get the time ghost. And she's like, oh, but is it a river or a road? Shut up. There's a time ghost.
Yeah, I had to have that conversation of like, okay, we're actually getting to the point where we're dealing with the consequences of this character messing with the timeline. So I just made the blanket statement. I was like, look, scientifically and logically speaking, diverging timelines and multiverse theory makes the most sense. From a storytelling standpoint, it's boring and it sucks.
Mm-hmm.
From a storytelling standpoint, multiverse theory is boring and it sucks. So, yeah. We're not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings up the other problem with this, which is, in a book, you have time. Like, for one thing, you have time to write it and rewrite it. And you people will read it and reread it, and you really want it to hold together as a cohesive whole, so you buy the world. And, you know, there's a whole argument of how much world building is owed, but
sure.
Like, in a tabletop game, especially one that's not being recorded for an actual play or anything like that, the primary objective is to make sure that everyone at the table is having fun and feeling balanced. And so it's much less important to me that, we have a cohesive, magic system than it is that her magic is not more powerful than other members of the party, so everyone feels like they can contribute and everybody has fun.
Oh, there are so many plot holes in my campaign that you've all mercifully forgotten about.
Yep.
So then
there was that whole period at the beginning where I hadn't quite figured out what the deal was with your supervillain mom. And so I was just saying stuff and hoping something would stick.
Amazing. So then, Grant, for you being the GM, what's the hardest aspect of these types of systems for you?
I think the hardest part of GMing a Powered by the Apocalypse system is, I think, because you don't roll dice. One of the constants is that the GM never touches the dice. You just react to what the players do. And so the hardest part as a GM is, one, balancing the spotlight. Because since, like Paige said, there's no formal initiative system.
Yeah.
It's all about just managing the spotlight for what's dramatically appropriate. So if it's dramatically appropriate, I might let this person make two moves in a row. Because the sort of the dreaded thing that can happen in a more traditional grid-based D20 game is when it's dramatically appropriate for you to charge and, cleave the orc's head off, but then you go 1, 2, 3, 4, I can't quite make it.
Yep.
It's like, so on my turn, I run all the way up there, I heft my sword over my head, and then I wait 6 seconds. Like, and I hate that.
Yeah.
I hate that more than anything in the world. Like, every time that happens in a grid-based game, anytime that happens in a game of 5e, my heart breaks a little bit. Because, like, that's my big problem with a lot of those kinds of games, is that the mechanics in a lot of cases actively get in the way of the fun. And that is a prime example of, like, the mechanics are impeding the fun and impeding the story. And so, you know, obviously there's no movement tracking in Masks, so that won't happen because of that,
mm-hmm.
right? To say I go over there, you just say you go over there. But if you're trying to do something a little bit complicated that's going to be a multi-stage thing, I'm not going to make you get halfway through the cool maneuver you wanted to do and then wait.
Sure.
While everybody else does their thing.
Yeah.
And part of the reason for that, one, is because it's just more dramatically fun to let the whole thing play out in one sequence. But two, since I never touch the dice, the only time I get to move my pieces on the board, like if you're fighting a supervillain, the only time I let the supervillain do something is in response to you doing something. If you do something and you succeed, I can do what's called a soft move, which is altering the scene in a way that is important but doesn't actively harm the party.
Okay.
The party can still react.
Yeah. Or if you fail, I can do a hard move, which is going to be making your life worse.
Mm-hmm.
Without the chance to react.
Yeah, yeah. The example, or, you know, sort of the phrase that gets thrown around to help people understand the difference between those two things is, a soft move is showing you the gun. A hard move is just shooting you.
Okay.
Right?
Got it.
And so then balancing that of like, okay, I need to do something now that complicates the situation in a way that gives the rest of the party an opportunity to act. But you succeeded, so I shouldn't make it too bad. But I gotta do something. And then all of that, plus the fact that just I as a GM, I'm a softie as a GM. I don't want to hurt my babies. They're my children. I love them. I want them to succeed, but also I'm in charge of making their lives harder.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you have one of our players in the corner yelling, "Hurt me more!"
Yeah. Just yesterday, we happened to be hanging out with somebody who is that player in my game, and we have game again tomorrow, where, like, her character is at the center of everything that's going on, and has had a rough go of it lately. So I went up to her while we were just, like, out and about, and I was like, "So, how much can I hurt you next session? Because I know you like the drama, but you've been through it. So, like, should I go easy on you, or can I hurt you next session?" And her exact words were, "Hurt me, daddy."
And then she apologized for making it weird.
Yeah. Especially because she said that in front of Paige's parents.
It's great, guys.
So, like, I think for me personally, that's the hardest part as a GM, is just that balancing act,
mm-hmm.
of, like, okay, you did the thing, but the villain does technically get a, like, pseudo turn now, so what can they do that is hard but not too much, and things like that. And then just, like, I don't know, finding the ways to balance that, because, like, specifically in the genre, teen superhero stories, they're usually not always uppers.
Right.
For whatever reason, the teenage superheroes are usually the ones who have to go through the most.
Yeah.
And
it's because life is the most when you're a teenager, Grant.
It's true. Life is the most when you're a teenager. And so trying to balance
actually
that.
Because I think teen superheroes as a genre are the genre that are least about actual supervillain fights and most about where you're growing and changing as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're teen dramas with supervillain set dressing.
Yeah. And so finding the right way to balance that in a way that keeps the drama going and keeps the villains or just whatever obstacles feeling properly threatening without making it feel insurmountable,
mm-hmm.
is probably the biggest challenge. The second biggest challenge, like we talked about how the move system works, and it's just when you do something in the narrative that triggers a thing,
mm-hmm.
that's when it happens. It means I have to be listening all the time to what the players are doing, especially because in masks, one major thing of masks specifically we haven't talked about is your stats aren't like strength, dex, whatever. Yeah. Your stats are called labels, and they're just how you see yourself. Am I dangerous? Am I a freak? Am I a savior? Am I better than other people because of my powers? Or am I just a normal kid? Those are your five things. It's danger, freak, savior, superior, and mundane. And depending on how you see yourself, that determines what your bonus or penalty is to certain types of roles. And another key thing is you're a teenager. Your self-image is, you're still figuring out who you are. Mm-hmm. So those labels change constantly. Okay. Your stats are not set in stone.
Interesting.
Got it.
And there's a lot of things that can, make them change. One of the things that can make them change is if a character has influence over you, mm-hmm. which by default, all adults have influence over you. And then just, there's a thing where you can hand around influence cards between the party.
Yeah.
If they say something that is clearly either directly or more passive aggressively indicating what they, how they feel you are, how they feel you should be, then
like,
that can,
this is too dangerous, let the adults handle it.
Okay.
Yeah, like, set this one out, kid, let the adults handle this. Then, implicitly, that is trying to move your danger down. You're not dangerous. You're not a threat. You can't handle something that big. Or possibly savior down, depending on the, you know, depending on context.
Mm-hmm.
And mundane up, right? And so then I have to be listening for that all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, if I make an NPC say it, then I can more. But if I have to be keeping track of, oh, hey, wait. Like, Paige, you just said to this other player, like, you know, don't worry. Don't worry. Whenever we're in a fight, I'm always going to protect you. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to make this other person, that's implying that they can't take care of themselves necessarily, or they might see it that way, even if that's not how you meant it.
Mm-hmm.
They might see it as, I don't think you can take care of yourself. That's going to be shifting, like, danger down, mundane up, possibly.
Yeah.
And so then I have to be listening for that, of like, wait, you just did a thing. Okay, hold on. Whether she means to or not, she's shifting your labels that way. Do you accept that? And you can either just take the change, or you can roll to try to resist it. And, you know, then stuff happens, like mechanics get engaged because of that. So I'm not having to worry about rolling dice or managing anybody's moves or turns or anything. But in return, I'm having to just constantly be listening for when these mechanics are engaged.
Right.
And yeah, the players can try to help, but ultimately it's my job. And so I would say that's the hardest part about GMing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But like, on the flip side, comparing it to GMing, say, a D20 game, I don't have to be pulling up a giant monster stat block and keeping track of all of those things in combat.
Right.
So it's a trade-off.
Okay.
Gotcha.
It sounds to me, too, like something that I think is worth mentioning and worth considering for anybody who's wanting to lean into one side or the other. Again, just as an observation, I feel like for a system like Masks, it requires a little bit more trust in your GM, right?
As yes, opposed to absolutely.
Something like D&D, where the mechanics are very clearly laid out for you. Again, you know exactly what your character is and is not able to do, and that's very mechanically defined. Whereas, you know, to use your exact example, Grant, of like, okay, I can only move these six spaces and then I have to stop on my turn, like that's laid out. Whereas if you're the one controlling the spotlight for those characters, like it can be very easy for somebody to be like, well, why are you letting them take this extra long turn and not me, right? Why are you letting them run up and do this whole like complex series of hit, kick, smash face, you know, kind of thing? Whereas I only got to like run around and shoot an arrow that last turn, right? I think that's
in Masks, hit, kick, smash face is all just one roll, but
well, fair.
I understand your point. Carry on.
Yeah. But I think that's important for people to consider too. And that's something that I've noticed. That's just a corollary that I've seen just in the 5e games that I've played, is games where I'm playing with people that I trust more involve less dice. So it's when I'm playing with basically you four, the dice are just not flying, right? Whereas if I'm playing with a group of people that I don't know very well, the dice are just constantly determining everything, because there's that level of trust that plays into like how much do we trust each other to rely on just the narrative as opposed to letting the mechanics, you know, determine everything for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it should be stated as well that, like, not only is trusting your GM is important, but trusting the rest of the players is important.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
You can do a pickup game of Masks. Grant has done it, where you just play at a con and, you know, you have a team of superheroes for a one shot and then you put it down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of people who have very successful Masks groups on Roll20 who, like, you know, met randos and played a really fun superhero game. But I think, like, the reason both of our ongoing Masks campaigns have worked so well is, regardless of, you know, how well we know each other or how often we've played with each other, they're groups that we trust not to, like, screw each other over. And so that lets you do things like one of our, like, two of our players had a really messy, horrible breakup in game. One of them died for a little bit and that soured their relationship. But, like, you can't do that and, like, really explore the emotional consequences and get the most out of that game. Like, the other side of getting more role-playing in is that you're probably exposing things that are vulnerable. Like, you're exposing yourself to more bleed. Mm-hmm. And so, are you playing with people who you feel comfortable doing that with?
That's actually something I wanted to get into a little bit was, so you see tons of studies on how D&D has influenced children, not so much the Satanic Panic, but I mean, like, it's increased or helped develop math skills, verbal skills, you know, mm-hmm. test scores go up, etc., because they're using all these skills that they would be learning in school, and how that's influencing brain development. I don't know, and I haven't looked into this, so maybe you guys can correct me if you know at all, as many studies on these kinds of RP-heavy mechanic games. So I was curious, I'm curious to hear what you think about how these kind of games can change or influence individuals as they're going through a campaign in them.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any, like, on these specifically. I know there's a lot about LARP, just because, right. like, there's a lot of, like, especially when you get into Nordic LARP, it gets weird, man.
Right.
And there's a lot about bleed in that. And I think, like, Sarah Lynn Bowman, who you've had on before, has talked about that some. But it is interesting in Masks, just looking at every player we've got and looking at the, like, the playbook they chose and the central conflict of that character mm-hmm. and saying, oh, I, like, because I know you as a person, I can kind of see something, in, like, I don't want to make assumptions about them, but I can kind of see something in that playbook that you're working through with that character.
Mm-hmm. Do you see your friends, like, change through that?
I don't know if it's necessarily a change, but I know for me there have been times where, like, I mean, I do not necessarily want to be more like my character in Masks. She's sure. 17. She's emotionally volatile. Like, she
she's
is incredibly
kind of the worst
defensive.
Sometimes.
She's the worst. Like, she's a messy drama baby, and she needs to grow up. Like, just deal with your issues. But there are, like, one thing that I really like about her as a character is she, in some ways, she very much cares what other people think, but in other ways, she feels very free to speak her mind.
Okay.
And there have been, like, not many, but there have been a few moments where it's like, it's not even like, what would Bruja do? But there have been moments where, like, this is the second sacrilegious, like, superhero comparison I've made this episode. But it's more like there are moments where I'm like, it's easier to slip into that mode of thinking and remember that, that, like, anything I role play and put on the table is something that comes from me. It's not something, like, some of it is stuff that I've made up as a fiction, but a lot of it is stuff that I have access to as a person. And when you practice having access to that, mm-hmm. it's easier to have access to that in other situations.
Yeah. Well, and I even think about, like, even when we're talking about characters that we don't necessarily want to emulate regularly, like, but, you know, I think about that with, like, Grimace as a character, right, that I've played for a Glass Dagger series, and I like, the thing that I find liberating about playing Grimace is he's just very impulsive, and he mm-hmm. just, like, I want to do this thing, this is the thing that I think is important right now, I'm just going to go do it, which is really helpful for me to, it's just liberating for me, who is normally the analysis paralysis type of person, to just, like, nope, forget the consequences, I'm just jumping in, right? And mm-hmm. that is like a useful thing for us to be able to just, even if it's not something we're going to practice in real life, even if it's not something we're going to allow to bleed over, it just like feels good once in a while to be like, nope, I don't care about the consequences, I'm just going to do it and see what happens.
But I think, speaking as your friend, I have seen you become more impulsive than, like, even in the course of this podcast, right? You and I were so timid when we first started. And fair, now you're far more fair. Outspoken in the best ways possible. So you didn't, you know, become an immature dragonborn, sure. you know, leaping off buildings. But I think I've seen you trust your gut more frequently in a really cool way. Just to affirm you.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome.
Fair. Well, roleplay is a safe place to say, like, what happens if I'm more impulsive? Because, like, as another person who likes to analyze everything, it's like, okay, but what if I just did it?
Right.
Would the world collapse?
Right.
And because it's, like, a fiction where you can control everything, really, honestly, you can still say, like, what does this look like? And that, like, gives you, like, the structure of what it feels like to do that. And it's easy to remap.
Yeah.
Right.
I really love masks, you guys.
Well, I think...
You know, Alan might want to roll wrap up, but we haven't gotten to Forged in the Dark. Let's go another hour.
I feel like it needs to be said that at about 5 or 6 different points during this recording, I had to hold myself back from, like, okay, but no, but if we dive into this one particular thing about masks, like, but this one
every time
really
we finish
cool.
a question, Alan like leans into the microphone just a little bit,
or like, okay, but like, for example, this really cool thing in my campaign right now,
this is the restrained version.
Yeah, this is the restrained version, and also it is a system that gets me excited about my own stories more than any other system I've run.
See, that's really...
our own stories.
Oh, well, let's just back away slowly.
It's true, though. Like, you know, Paige was being snarky, but it's actually, I think it's fair to say that the thing about a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse stuff is because it's so freeform and because it's so reactive. And one of the central principles in basically every Powered by the Apocalypse system is play to find out. Mm-hmm. It discourages the GM having like a really hard and fast plan. Which I know you can, like, you totally can play D20 in a more loose way like that, and like I have, like,
sure.
By no means am I saying, like, oh, D20, you have to plan everything, because you don't.
Mm-hmm.
But because Masks is specifically built for something that is more improvised and more flexible and more kind of seat of your pants,
yeah,
I think that it encourages that collaborative storytelling style. That, again, is totally doable in, like, 5e, but encourages it and is built specifically to help support it
yeah.
in a way that a lot of other systems aren't. And I think that's another underrated element of the engine.
See, and this conversation has been very helpful for me in defining the two, so then I can now pursue these kinds of games with a little more, not just enthusiasm, but confidence in what I'm going to get from them, because I had been in that mental state of like, I don't want to learn another system. I'm trying to better understand the systems I have before I get anything new. So it felt like a not just a financial burden, but an emotional burden, a mental burden to take this on. And now I just feel a little more confident
yeah.
about going forward with this style of play. And also feeling more confident about that kind of style of play being well received, because again, a lot of the people that we'd play with, if we were playing with people we hadn't played with before, were more familiar with the idea of a D20 system than they
yeah.
were anything else. So the idea of trying to teach somebody something that is not only unfamiliar, but also asking them to be a little more emotionally available than just combat, I kind of just assumed they'd be like, no, that's
it was
weird.
Always a bit of a sticking point.
Right. Yeah. But now I feel a little more encouraged to go forward and forge ahead.
Maybe after we're done with Lady Blackbird, maybe we can do a short arc of something powered by the apocalypse.
Yes, please.
That would be fun. Well, not to be the buzzkill, but we are pushing 90 minutes already.
Alan is the big bad of podcasting.
Sorry.
No, this has been fantastic.
Buzzkill.
This has been honestly fantastic.
I mean, to be fair, Paige and Grant, what are you guys doing next week?
Tis true. Until then, though, minmaxpod@gmail.com, minmaxpod on all the socials except Reddit, /u/minmaxpodcast, 773-789-9369 is a voicemail number for voicemails 3 minutes or less. Anything longer than that, you can send that to our email address. We choose to respond to those on the podcast sometimes. We also miss getting voicemails and emails. It's been a very, very long time. It's lonely in the digital verse. Please, please come say hi. We miss you all. I'm at Alan H. Mowers on Twitter. Ashley's at DEDE_K. Kyle's at Stainbrook Kyle. Paige Grant, where can people find you on the interwebs if they want to follow some of the things or some of the potential other things you could do in the future?
Well, yeah, technically, it is technically done now, but it's evergreen. If you haven't already, you can check out our podcast, Gilmore Ball Z. Which is just go to any social media and search Gilmore Ball Z, and it's on all the major podcasting platforms. If you've forgotten or haven't seen any of our previous episodes, every episode, she shows me an episode of Gilmore Girls, and I show her an episode of Dragon Ball Z, and we have progressively less fun as we get further into Gilmore Girls and Dragon Ball Z. But you have a lot of fun, because the human brain is wired to find people who we don't know as pain enjoyable. So if you want us in a podcast form, there's that. If you just, I don't know, like us and want more of our thoughts, I am on Twitter at GPLOWE, that's GPLOWE 92.
And I'm on Twitter at Paige, PAIGE 3, the digit, LOWE.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, guys. This has been fantastic, and we are going to have to run a masks something or other at some point in the future. But until next week, Nampersands.
I don't think I can ever get tired of masks, so I'm into that.
Yeah. We'll see you guys next week.